Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 254, and it's Skop, Skeet and Donna on the Day of the Dead Moon. Morning of January 22nd, 1879 dawned with a deceptive stillness across Zululand, masking the fact that over 45,000 men were in motion across a 200-kilometer front, each group operating in a vacuum of information that would, by sunset, shatter the British Victorian ego. At the coast, Colonel Charles Pearson's column number 1 represented the textbook invasion. His force was a heavy industrial machine led by the 3rd Foot Regiment, the Buffs, along with the 99th Regiment and the Naval Brigade, dragging their heavy Gatling guns and artillery. By 5 a.m., the 5,000-strong column was already a dusty serpent stretching more than 8 kilometres back toward the Tugela River. Pearson's scouts were a mix of the Natal native contingent and European volunteers who pushed through the tall grass toward the Inyezani River. They were being observed from the Mwambani Mountain by the Udududu, the Mbube, and the Sikho regiments. 6,000 warriors under the command of Gudidi Kaindlela. Mwambani Mountain lay on the wagon trail between Ging and Lovu on the coastal flats, and Ishowe, where Pearson was hoping to set up a main base at the abandoned Norwegian mission station before pushing on to Undini, Gachwayo's HQ. The Zulu plan was traditional: await in complete stillness on the high ground, then sweep in for a surprise ambush. Pearson's advanced guard crossed the Inyezani River at 7:30 a.m. Thick bush grew all around. The cavalry was reconnoitring and saw nothing. Vedettes, or mounted guards, were placed to keep an eye out for the Zulu army. Pearson's main party reached the knoll selected for the first stop at around 8 a.m., and the men began to outspan the oxen for a late breakfast. As the laager was being formed up, a party of the Natal native contingent, who scouted ahead, attracted fire from Zulu snipers. There was the click-clack of the Gatling gun being readied just in case, as well as the 7-pounder guns being pulled into a defensive position. These were the ominous precursors to the next shots of the day. British Commander Pearson was supremely confident of his firepower and the discipline of the regular troops, who were veterans of colonial combat. It was at this moment that the majority of Gedide's army came sweeping over the Wombani Mountain, seeking to surround Pearson's column. As with Sandlwana, which we'll deal with in a moment, the Zulu trap had been prematurely sprung by a patrol, in this case, the Natal native contingent. Captain Hart ordered the NNC to retreat, and later he described what happened.
"I saw at once that we had almost fallen into a trap, and I instantly gave the order, 'Retire!' At the same moment, the Zulus poured down the hill by hundreds at the top of their speed with a tremendous shout, while others above kept up the fire over the heads of those descending the hill. Hart did not know that one of his lieutenants, along with 2 sergeants and 2 corporals, had already been overcome by the warriors and speared to death in a nearby ravine. The latest Zulu tactic, which would also be repeated at Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift, and, as Evelyn Wood would report from Klubani Mountain, was a combination of heavy fire from the high ground in support of a surging attack by warriors on foot. The road was now completely commanded by Gudide, along with the all-important high ground, and as his snipers fired non-stop, the Zulu horns swept towards the exposed British column, threatening to engulf it. Naval officer Midshipman Lewis Coker had the honour of commanding the first Gatling gun to be used in combat by British troops. Pearson had recognised the value of this machine gun, and he ordered Coker to take up a position opposite the advancing Zulu. Coker fired off 300 rounds, and the Zulu attack shuddered and halted. Then the sound of the rockets fiendishly shrieking led to a general Zulu withdrawal. Hart and his men advanced on the retreating Zulu when one of the older warriors, his oiled head ring glistening in the morning sun, stopped and turned, fell to one knee in a classic rifleman's position, took careful aim and fired, but missed. The warrior bolted away. Hart noted the conventional approach this older warrior had taken. He'd been trained in the finer arts of fire and movement, it appeared. By 9:30, the Zulu right horn began to wilt and collapsed, but the left horn and chest, Amabutu, fought on. Umkhapo Regiment Chief Zimema in the center explained how Gudidi's men came close to victory. As we advanced, we had our rifles under our arms and had our assegais and our right hands ready to throw them, but they were not much good. They could just not get close enough for the assegais to do their work. Although we tried to climb over our fallen brothers, we could not get very far ahead because the white men were firing heavily close to the ground. The fighting was so fierce that Zimema said survivors wiped the blood of the dead and wounded from their heads and faces, their arms and their legs and their shields afterwards. Pearson found himself both surprised and impressed by the Zulu resolve he had witnessed. At least 400 warriors had fallen in the fighting. British casualties stood at 14 dead, 15 wounded. After seeing to the burial of his dead, Pearson pushed his column onwards towards Ishowe, eventually bivouacking for the night on a ridge 6 kilometres beyond the battlefield. The column reached the Norwegian mission station at 10 on the morning of January 23rd, and Pearson immediately set his men to work entrenching. His plan was to construct a defensive position at Ishowe for his surplus stores, then push on to Undini within a few days. What actually happened was that the fort found itself besieged by Zulu warriors for 72 days. We'll return to that saga in later podcasts. Meanwhile, 200 kilometres to the north of Pearson, near the modern town of Freyheit, Colonel Evelyn Wood, who led the left column of the British Triple Column invasion, was preparing his morning assault atop Zingwini Mountain. Wood was by far the most experienced and therefore pragmatic of the British commanders. He had the good fortune of commanding the flying column. A vast majority of his men were mounted. The force was centred on the 13th and 90th Light Infantry and the formidable Frontier Light Horse under Redvers Buller. As the sun rose on the 22nd, Wood sat on his horse, looking through his glass at the Abakulusi forces manoeuvring on the slopes of Hlobane Mountain. That's a few kilometres northeast of the modern town of Freyheit. Earlier in the campaign, Wood had avoided a scorched earth policy, but by the third week of the invasion, his softly approach had failed, and he was now burning kraals and capturing cattle. The change in strategy was also tactical. He hoped to draw Abakulusi strength away from the centre, provoking them into an attack. He was partly successful. The Zulu forces in the north were agitated and concentrated and ready to strike back. Wood took the 90th Light Infantry, 2 guns and the mounted troops up the steep western slope of the Zungwini. The appearance at the summit took the Abakulusi by surprise, and by the late afternoon of the 22nd they had driven more than 1,000 warriors down onto the Intianka Neck that led to the neighbouring peak of Hlobane. Wood's force made its way to the eastern edge of the Zungwini and spotted at least 4,000 warriors on the northern slopes of the Hlobane, Abakulusi, as well as Mbilini's men from the Pongola region. Having cleared the Zungwini, Wood decided to descend and rejoin the 13th Light Infantry. He'd been left at the foot of the mountain, and they bivouacked for the night. It was then they heard the distant boom of cannon fire from the direction of Zandluana, 80 kilometres away to the south. The firing heard after dark was a bad sign. "Indicating," said Wood, "an unfavourable situation." It is to this unfavourable situation we now turn. It was in the centre of the three-pronged British invasion where the day of Skop, Skeet and Donner would change history. This was at the foot of the Sphinx-like crag of Zandluana, where Chelmsford's second column hunkered down. At 2:30 a.m. on the 22nd, the camp was a hive of whispered orders and clinking harnesses. Lord Chelmsford, convinced by Major Dartnell's frantic reports of a large force to the southeast, decided to split his strength, the cardinal sin of Victorian warfare. Dartnell had led a reconnaissance force to clear the Mangeni Valley to the southeast the day before and had been ensnared in a Zulu ploy to split up the British central column. Chelmsford now wanted to protect Dartnell and rode out with the 6th Carbineers, parts of the 2nd and 24th Regiment, and the 4th Natal Native Contingent, leaving behind a truncated force under Lieutenant Colonel Henry Poulain. This left-behind force
was the 1st and 24th Foot, a veteran of the Cape Frontier Wars, along with 2 7-pounder guns of the 5th Brigade Royal Artillery and a battalion of Natal Native Contingent, about 1,500 in all. Dartnell's men had huddled on the Hlazakazi Heights overnight. The terrifying darkness had caused more than one panic, and their blood pressure rose on the morning of the 22nd when they heard the sound of horses through the pea soup thick cold mist. It was Lord Chelmsford and his staff who appeared, riding to their rescue. The track from San Juan had proved difficult to negotiate at night, and Chelmsford's relief column was now stretched for several kilometres. The 6 artillery pieces had a particularly difficult trip, bogging down in dongas, being winched out with ropes. These vital weapons were even further back in the mist. As the sun burned off the white swirls of Zululand's summer moisture through the morning, Chelmsford peered at the summits of the Mogogo and the Siluchana Mountains, where Chief Machani Kamondisa was supposed to be. If you recall last episode, he had been sent as a decoy, and the Zulu plan had worked. Chelmsford was stressing out. Where had Machani gone? It was crucial to find out where he and his warriors were. In the British ranks, officers with more experience in fighting in Africa, muttered in discontent at the apparent haphazard tactics being deployed. Lieutenant Colonel Glynn, who'd been superseded by Lord Chelmsford, rode over to Natal Native Contingent Commander Maori Hamilton Brown, shook his head, and replied, "I am not in command," after Hamilton Brown asked him why he had left Isandlwana. Machani Makamundisa's decoys had a very important job. They were heavily armed, and after spending the night in their Mangeni Gorge, a core group emerged into the daylight to take stock. It was almost the end of the road for the wily chief, because when he was told that there were men with shields on the Hlazakazi Hills, he presumed they were Quechuaos. They were Chelmsford's NNC. Machani set off towards what he thought were allies, mounted on his favourite horse. The sight and sound of British rifles crackling changed his point of view, and Machani was caught in a crossfire. In a desperate act, his senior chiefs told him to ride away and created a diversion. All died saving their senior leader that day. The rest of the Zulu army melted into the crags and ravines, revealing themselves for a moment, then disappearing, reappearing some distance away, repeating the action. By doing so, they convinced the British there was still a large Zulu army in the area, whereas in reality, most had marched to join the main army to the north of Isandlwana. It was mid-morning, and Chelmsford still had no idea of the Amabuto's intentions, or even their numbers. So he stopped and decided to have brunch, just to chew over things. There was still enough time at this point for the British commander to change history had he decided to return to Isandlwana. As he chewed on his brunch, he was considering his options. There was little point, he thought, in ordering the force all the way back to the Sphinx-like hill of Isandlwana, only to pack up the following day to march back east to the position he now commanded. More than half his column was with him, so he sent word to Poulain and Durnford for the garrison to pack up and join him the same day. It was unlikely those left at Isandlwana would complete the journey before dark, and they would need help packing up. So Chelmsford ordered a battalion of the Natal Native Contingent back to Isandlwana to help strike the tents and load the wagons. There, Commander Hamilton Brown was summoned to receive orders. He was hungry, tired, and hot, and reported later,
"Never shall I forget the sight of that peaceful picnic. Here were the staff, quietly breakfasting, and the whole command scattered over the country."
Neither Hamilton Brown nor his men had eaten since breakfast the previous day. Chelmsford offered him a tasty morsel, but he declined, pointing out that none of his men had eaten, so he would also go without, which was standard practice. Chelmsford's staff officer, Colonel Craddock, turned to Brown and bluntly ordered him to take his colonial force of mounted cavalry and NNC back to Isandlwana and help Poulain pack. Brown admitted later that upon hearing this, he nearly fell off my horse. His men had been on the move for 2 days, with very little sleep, ordered hither and thither. They had received no rations. Now they were ordered thither once more. It was the kind of senseless and thoughtless vacillation that characterized the nature of the Victorian general.
If I come across the enemy?
Brown asked Krillick.
Oh, said Krillick, just brush them aside and go on.
With that, the smug colonel continued tucking into his brunch, dismissing Hamilton Brown. So, dear listener, as Chelmsford continued to ride toward the smoke and mirrors of Machani Kamundisa's decoys, the day would soon reveal a terrifying reality. While Chelmsford hunted shadows in the Mangeni Valley, the main Zulu impi, the chest of the king, was lying in a silent 8-kilometer-long crescent just over the ridge from Bulain's camp. They weren't visible at first. At 10:30 a.m., Colonel Anthony Durnford arrived at Isandlwana with a detachment of his column in order to reinforce the camp. He took over command from Bulain, and now the joint force at his disposal numbered 1,768 men and officers. Half of the defenders were comprised of the Natal native contingent, who had received little training and were inadequately armed. Durnford was impetuous, as plucky as a lion, but as imprudent as a child. His next decision would be his last act of imprudence on planet Earth. Durnford had spotted some Zulu moving in the distance, men who it was believed were on their way to support Machani to the east, with reports that Dartnell was on the ropes at Hlazakazi and Chelmsford's relieving force was on the way there. Perhaps these men were going to join Machani. Instead of playing it safe and tightening the camp's defences, Durnford decided actions speak louder than words. At about 11:30 a.m., he rode out of the camp with 104 mounted men, as well as a company of the NNC and his rocket battery. Before cantering out, he ordered Captain Theophilus Shepston Jr., who led the Natal native horse, to scout the Inyoni Heights, which lay to the north. Durnford's last words to Poulain were that he expected support if the two scouting forces got into difficulty. The Zulu Durnford had spotted were what you could call a logistics unit. They were foragers tasked with replenishing supplies from deserted mealie fields and abandoned livestock. They were part of the massive Zulu main army. The Zulu commanders now realized they had Chelmsford's column at a fatal disadvantage, and yet they were considering cosmology and ritual. The gargantuan Zulu force of 20,000 warriors, commanded by the veteran Inchingwayo Kamaholi and Mavumingwana Kandlela, were supposed to take the day of the 22nd of January off. It was the day of the Umuzi Wenyanga, or the day of the new moon, a time when the moon was dead and the Zulu were spiritually forbidden from launching an attack. A more auspicious time was the next day, Monday, the 23rd. By midday of the 22nd, the regiments were packed into the Ingwebeni Valley northeast of Isandlwana like a coiled spring, fidgety, motivated, heating up. In the chest, the center, the Utkani, the Unudwengu, and Ududu Corps were arranged. Their role was to smash into the center of British defences. The Veve and Ngobama Kosi, or the Bendu of Kings, were the left horn, the Opondo Lwasekhohlo. These were the young, aggressive warriors tasked with outflanking the British right. The Zulu left horn, the Opondo Lwasekhoneni, comprised of the Ududu and the Unukenke. They were going to swing around the back of Isandlwana Mountain, striking the British left flank. The Uluvi, the Dloko, and the Utulwana were held in reserve. These were the veterans, the king's own age-grade warriors, to be used as a last-ditch attempt at success, should they be required. This army of 20,000 men sat in such absolute silence that the British pickets, half a kilometre away, heard nothing but the wind. The WTF or OMG moment of the morning occurred when one of Shepston's officers, Lieutenant Charles Raw, of the Basutu Mounted Police, chased a few Zulu foragers who'd been seen herding cattle towards the edge of the Ingwebeni Ravine. They charged after the men who disappeared into a gully on the Mabaso Heights. Raw didn't find a scouting party. He found virtually the entire Zulu army looking back at him. There was no war cry. There was simply the sound of men rising to their feet, the dry rustle of legs against grass, and the beginning of a rhythmic drumming of assegais against shields. The dead moon had been disturbed, and as a shadow began to creep across the sun, the Zulu impi decided that if they could not honour the moon, they would honour the king with blood.
The Nokenke had armed themselves and begun to run forward until they were ordered back to their place. The Mkliyu regiment had also been triggered, but they too were pulled back. The crack Ngobamakosi men, on the other hand, ignored the British patrol and continued cooking and eating their mealies. The Recce patrol were stunned and horrified. They were well trained. They dismounted immediately, firing a volley into the massive Zulu army before leaping back on their horses and beating a hasty retreat to Isandlwana. This act of firing into the midst snapped the Amabutu's patience, and the entire army rose to its feet. The long wait was over. It was time to fight. What happened next is for next episode. The Battle of Inyezani is over. Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift follow in short order. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about these episodes. You can email me from there and also sign up for a newsletter. Until we meet again, salagatle.